We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, former co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
And live has a whole added meaning this week based on what you've gone through.
Yeah, I had an interesting medical experience the last couple of weeks, but I'm back. So
you are.
Can't get rid of me that easily.
Nope.
goodness knows the universe tried, but no, not yet.
R&D department's working on that. So
yeah. So, and Maria's gone this week, but she'll be back. She decided to take a week off and do a cool climate change, which is spending the weekend in the cool confines of New York City in June, which is supposed to be hot and sweltering, but is actually a cooler option this week. So there you go.
One of the rare times where that happens during the summer. So at least during this summer.
Yep.
All right. So
stay cool today, everyone.
Yes. Yes. Everyone needs to drink plenty of liquids this weekend of your choice.
Yes. And we'll get to that shortly.
We will. All right. So starting out with Olympia last night, a budget deal apparently was reached.
Yeah. About 1:30 in the morning in the second special legislative session and nearing the deadline for that. So they don't have to go to a third one. And all the people who are actually running for office can actually raise money now. A tentative budget deal. We don't know any of the details yet. We do know that it's likely to not be a very good budget based on budget out of the Senate Republicans that was part of what was being negotiated around. So we'll have more details on that next week. But for the time being, we at least know that they won't be going into a third special legislative session, and some kind of deal has been cut. And we'll just have to wait probably until Monday to find out exactly how bad it is and the details. We do know that there won't be any of the widespread revenue increases that are needed to actually keep up with funding for a lot of the essential programs that the state has continued to cut back on. That trend is likely to continue this year, and the question is what's going to be cut and what can be salvaged.
All right. Moving back to very local here in Seattle, Mayor Murray has had a busy week.
Yeah, a couple of developments this week in Seattle land, which is theory that I have that all the development that we've been seeing is basically turning Seattle into a series of neighborhood theme parks that are all. Essentially organized around the idea of increasing real estate values by having particular themes and attractions to each neighborhood that really aren't oriented toward people who are living there now or who have been living there in the past. They're oriented toward increasing property values and selling real estate. And so we have our gay-themed neighborhood up on Capitol Hill where people who have lived there historically can't afford to live there anymore, and hate crimes are in the increase because of all the non-gay people, upscale young professionals who are moving into the neighborhood. And but we do have rainbow-colored sidewalks now at $70,000 or something like that a pop. So that'll be something for the postcards and something for the tourists on the duck to point out as they drive past. And of course, you know, people will be very proud of that this weekend, I'm sure. We also had a development downtown yesterday, which is pretty disturbing. It's something the Downtown Seattle Association, which is the trade group of big retailers that has traditionally played a dominant role in Seattle politics. And, you know, when we talk about downtown interests, we talk about the DSA, basically, as the Chamber of Commerce, but particularly the DSA. Well, Mayor Murray announced kind of casually that Westlake Park, the sort of traditional free speech zone where a lot of people hang out and really the only public space in the middle of downtown Seattle, the only thing that's even close to it otherwise are Freeway Park and Victor Steinbrück Park, which are kind of on the edges of downtown, and Denny Park up by Denny and Dexter, where we are. Mm-hmm. But in downtown proper itself, it's really the only open public space where people can congregate. Obviously, a lot of political protests happen there. A lot of other types of festivals and public gatherings happen there. Well, Murray announced that something the DSA has been pushing for a long time is coming to fruition. The city of Seattle is no longer going to operate Westlake Park. It will be subcontracted to and operated privately by the DSA. Now, that that already happens 6 weeks a year when the carousel gets set up during the holiday shopping season, during and after Thanksgiving and working its way up to Christmas. What we have seen traditionally during that period is that excludes almost all other public uses of the park. We've also seen during various times different commercial things that get set up in the park. So it's very likely, in my estimation at this point, that we're going to see a lot more of that with the DSA, where you won't necessarily have free speech in Westlake Park, because what you'll have instead is giant T-Mobile displays or kiosks or different other types of commercial promotions, this sort of thing. And what you won't have is the ability for ordinary people to congregate in a public space. And this has been an ongoing problem in Seattle and really nationally as well, where we're losing our public spaces. We're losing places where people can congregate in areas that are operated by the public. Really, in a lot of places, particularly once you get outside central cities, the place where people congregate are malls, and those are private properties that can be operated however the mall operator wants in terms of who they allow in, who they allow out. And now we're seeing that with the downtown Seattle also, which in many ways, certainly in the retail district, more and more resembles a mall. To my mind, it's a very very disturbing disturbing development. And then we've also seen aspects of this where private security at Westlake and various other places downtown has also been a real problem in terms of being even more problematic than SPD and how they treat people who they don't perceive as being the ideal shoppers. Again, we're seeing under Mayor Murray this sort of veneer of progressivism, while the city itself is more or less auctioned off to the highest bidder, whether it be developers or commercial interests or whatever it is, and this is very much another step in that direction.
So from my reading, since its initial one-year pilot program for doing this at Westlake and Occidental Park, because of the one-year tag on it, they could circumvent going through a public process?
That's correct. And the question will then be, at the end of the year, is there any kind of public process that's necessary to make it permanent, or whether they can just renew it as another, you know, one-year thing or whatever. But again, this is another example where not only are the decisions bad, the public process is bad, because the decisions are all being made behind closed doors. This is a proposal that nobody knew was even being considered, much like the smoking ban in the park, where there was a ruckus that was raised about it by activists, but it was basically a done deal before people ever found out about it, and it was just sort of a pro forma approval process by the Parks Department for a proposal that was already well on its way before anybody found out about it. And whether you agree with the policy or not, for all of these things, the process is very problematic, because it's emblematic of a long and unfortunate history in Seattle, where especially where money is concerned, the decisions are all made and then either presented to the public as fait accomplis or trotted before the public for public hearings that don't mean anything, because the decision's already been finalized.
And of course, we just had a recent vote on public parks and their further removal of oversight from, let's say, the Seattle City Council.
Yeah, that's correct. We had the vote last fall where the Parks District is no longer a department of the city. It's now its own separate independent agency with independent taxing authority that can make its own decisions. And ostensibly, the city council members are the ultimate decision-making authority on that. But of course, they have another full-time job already. So what it does is concentrate a great deal of power in the Parks Department itself. And that's been a problem over the years. The Parks Department has been one of these agencies in town, along with things like the Port of Seattle and the school district, where the staff really exercises an enormous amount of control and is either unresponsive to or openly contemptuous of the public that it supposedly serves.
All right. So that...
And there's also been a long-standing problem, even going back to the Nichols administration, of the Parks Department very much trying to use some of its valuable real estate as you know, trying to generate commercial commercial income from that real estate. So that's something to watch out for too. And the idea of privatizing the management of the parks, in this case Westlake and Occidental, is very much a piece with that.
Moving on to National and a couple very large decisions coming out of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and both of them very good news. We'll start with the one that happened first on Thursday. That was King v. Burwell, which was the last major challenge to the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. And this is one that a lot of legal scholars were mystified that it ever got to the Supreme Court, other than you had a couple very conservative circuit courts rule in favor of plaintiffs on this. But the basic argument of conservatives looking to overturn Obamacare in this was the wording in one section in which the way that it was drafted as a clerical error left ambiguous a phrase as to whether the individual mandate that helps to actually fund Obamacare, because of course you have to have a large enough pool of people being covered under the Affordable Care Act in order to be able to cover sick people, for example, and to ban bans of based on pre-existing conditions, this sort of thing. It's what makes Obamacare not only pencil out but actually save money for the federal government and for consumers in the long run. And this piece of it was being challenged based on some ambiguous language, even though literally a couple of words in one word in a, you know, couple thousand page document, even though the intent of Congress on this was very clear. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that that Obamacare would stand, and it tells you just how ideological the three opponents of this were, those being Thomas and Scalia and what's his name, the other reactionary one. I can't even remember his name, but it tells you how ideological that they are, that that there were automatic no votes on this, even though the language and intent on it should be fairly clear, it can't be thrown out, and so the Affordable Care Act will now stand as is. And the big challenge, longer term, of course, is going on to try and modify it to fix some of the problems with it, and hopefully move the country in more of a direction of a single payer policy. Because while Obamacare has certainly been a step forward, and it has helped get coverage for a number of people who previously weren't able to get it, it still has a number of holes and a number of flaws. There are a number of things that aren't covered. The ability of individual states to not expand Medicaid, and of course we've seen that not expanded in a number of Republican-controlled states, has left a lot of people in the lurch in the South and Midwest and Rocky Mountain states in particular. And so that all still needs to be addressed. Meanwhile, an enormously large historic ruling yesterday that gay marriage is now legal in all 50 states. That, again, a 5-4 decision along ideological lines. Anthony Kennedy, the conservative swing vote on the council, wrote actually the majority of the decision. And some of the language from that, really actually pretty inspiring. The right to marry is a fundamental right inherent in the liberty of the person. And under the due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment, couples of the same sex may not be deprived of that right and that liberty. The court now holds that same-sex couples may exercise the fundamental right to marry. No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. that is worth celebrating this weekend, coming the on the eve of Pride weekend. I think it's going to be quite the party this weekend. And even though it had already been legalized, that is same-sex marriage in a number of states, including Washington State, there was a real danger that if the court had, with one more vote, had ruled in the other direction, that that would have been undone in a number of states. So so good news all across the land today in that respect, and somewhat of a relief that even though it's very tenuous and a Republican president next year and one more conservative appointment to the Supreme Court could reverse an awful lot of the 5-4 decisions that we've seen in recent years. But for the time being, that is permanent, and that is the law of the land. Good news.
Good news, which we rarely report. As a general rule,
we try and slip one in every now and then just to keep people off balance.
Exactly. So they're like going, "What show are we listening to?" All right. Meanwhile, getting back to our usual stream of consciousness, Fast Track.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is not dead yet, even though it lost a crucial vote a couple of weeks ago in the House. But this past week in the Senate did pass fast-track authority for President Obama. And so that clears the way in the Senate, which is the legislative body that votes on treaties, to give a straight up or down vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that will be coming up shortly. Sadly, both Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, who are very anxious to do the bidding of Boeing, which is one of the prime corporate backers of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Both of them have voted in favor of fast-track authority. Both of them are expected to vote in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And we still don't know a lot of the details of what that is in the TPP, although from the pieces that have leaked and some of the comments of people who have seen copies of it, some very, very disturbing elements that that really do need to see the light of the day before before this thing is voted on. So so that's something we're going to need to pay a lot of attention to this summer. Meanwhile, also Amnesty International report that came out this week, speaking of not good news, looking at international standards as to use of force by police officers and law enforcement officers, and finding that of the 50 United States, not one of them is in compliance with international standards for use of force policies. In other words, the use of force policies that are in the use in the United States at all levels, federal, state, and local, are much more lenient than they are in basically the rest of the world. So the next time you hear of some jurisdiction like, oh, say, King County, where you've had hundreds of cases and in every single one of them use of force has been found to be justified, just remember that the standards they're judging that by are not standards that the rest of the world considers acceptable.
All right. And moving on, it was, by many accounts, a disastrous week for conservatives who are running for president.
Well, yeah, this is some of the fallout from some of the things that Maria talked about last week with the deadly murders in Charleston, South Carolina. And we continue to see some political fallout from that this week. A couple of things in particular. We saw Southern governors, including Nikki Haley in South Carolina, Bobby Jindal, who's running for president, who's the governor of Louisiana. Of course, there's about 45 different people who are actually running for the Republican nomination for president right now. But he's one of them. And others scrambling for photo ops to denounce the use of the Confederate flag and Haley calling it for it to be taken down from the State House, even though state law at this point prohibits it from being taken down by the State House. And the South Carolina State Legislature, even though they lost one of their own in Senator Roberta Pinckney, was one of the people who was killed in Charleston, in fact, was the original target of Dylann Roof. And he asked for Pinckney when he walked into the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. So in that respect, it was not only a terrorist act, but it was also specifically an assassination, something that a lot of media accounts nationally have not really focused on at all. But Even though the state legislature there lost one of their own, they're still willing to keep up the Confederate flag that was the inspiration for Dylann Roof, as he'd been the inspiration for a lot of neo-Confederate racists over the years, and the focus for it. And so we're seeing a lot of noise about that now, but at the end of the day, watch and see how often that flag actually is taken down, because it's the sort of thing that you know, people find offensive in a lot of parts of the country, and certainly a lot of people of color find offensive, and some whites as well in the South. But that's part of the point of why people fly it. That's part of the point of why they put their decals on their cars or their baseball caps or whatever, is they know it's offensive, and they like the fact that it's offensive. They like the fact that it pisses off Yankees and so on and so forth. That's part of the appeal of it. As well as the fact that it's, you know, sort of a white supremacist rallying cry, even though they might not think of it in exactly those terms. That's what it is, and that's what it's recognized as in the South. Because, you know, it doesn't just recognize the Southern heritage. It represents a particular kind of heritage for a particular segment of the population of the South. When you hear the shorthand of Southerners, what people are referring to almost always are white Southerners. That's an important distinction to make, because a large percentage of the population in the South actually is non-white, not just African-American, but now you have a large immigrant population as well. The demographics of the South have actually been changing quite rapidly in the last 20 years. And, you know, it's not really fair to the South or the people that live there to paint everybody as being white racist, because that's not true at all. But they're the people who've been in the news lately. Meanwhile, part of those conservative white racists, the Council of Conservative Christians, which for the last 30 or 40 years since the KKK became less socially acceptable, it's been one of the main sort of more polite white supremacist groups. It's sort of like the Elks or the Masons or you know, the Knights of Columbus or something, a Rotary Club, except it's for, you know, people who want to see the Confederacy restored and all the black ship back to Africa or something. But it's been an issue over the past number of years that occasionally politicians will get in trouble for speaking in front of a CCC chapter. So there was a senator from Mississippi that got in trouble for that a few years back, Trent Lott, for example. It turns out this week with the news that the CCC and its head were among the people that Dylann Roof was most inspired by, and in fact a lot of the things that he posted publicly were almost word for word taken from their website. Turns out that they've also been giving to presidential campaigns, in particular to Ted Cruz, to Rand Paul, to Rick Santorum, to several of the very conservative culture warrior type people running for the Republican nomination for president. Now, Cruz has actually had the good sense to give back that donation. Some of the others have not so far. But once again, it points up what you expected them to give money to the party with the black guy as the president. I don't think that's going to happen. So it really does point out not that all Republicans are racist, but most racists are in fact Republican, or at least the overt racists.
All right, and finally, on to international and the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, an ugly story developing in the Caribbean around the mass deportation of ethnic Haitians from the Dominican Republic. Those two countries share the island of Hispaniola, which is west of Puerto Rico and east of Cuba. And there's been a lot of tension between them over the years, Dominican Republican being Spanish-speaking and Haitian being Creole, traditionally French. Haiti being the original 1804 first successful slave revolt in the country, and has been punished by the West and been a historically very poor country ever since. And various mass emigrations from Haiti over the years with various often U.S.-supported dictatorships there So you have a large Haitian population in the Dominican Republic that has developed really over the last 70 or 80 years, and literally generations of Haitians who are citizens of the Dominican Republic by virtue of birth, even though they had Haitian parents. Well, there was a court ruling a couple of years ago in the Dominican Republic that stripped all those Haitians of citizenship, saying that they could not be citizens of the Dominican Republic unless their parents were as well. So now you have some 500,000 legally stateless Haitians at risk of mass deportation. The Dominican Republic did set up a process by which people could apply for permits to stay, but only 300 of the approximately 250,000 people who have applied have actually received those permits as yet. So it's and in many cases, you're talking about people whose parents or grandparents came from Haiti, but who have never actually set foot in the country themselves. It's somewhat similar to the phenomenon you have here of Mexican people who've grown up in the United States as children of undocumented people who came here, and the children or young adults being deported back to Mexico, even though they're fully American, don't speak Spanish, etc. You have that now at an island of maybe 20 million people between the two countries. A fairly large portion of the island's population is being forced to move from one country to the other, and the other country being a very poor and somewhat lawless country to begin with. The potential there for a massive human rights problem is unfolding before our eyes. So something to keep an eye on.
Haiti still recovering from the recent environmental disaster and lack of support from that.
Yeah, and an earthquake, and of course, 200 years of looting by the West. So all of those things.
All right.
It's a very unfortunate country.
I guess events. That's
yeah.
All I got left on my list.
Yeah, and of course, as we mentioned, the Pride weekend going on, a lot of different events around that. You can find out all the various details online. The big one coming up will be the Pride Parade tomorrow, which will go all day downtown to Seattle Center. People marshal at 11 o'clock at 4th and Union, but of course the actual staging area takes up a number of blocks downtown, and it takes several hours for the parade itself to unfurl. It is quite the party, and I imagine will be even more of a party this weekend, given the fabulous news from yesterday. So that's very exciting and very fun. One other event that's worth looking at, that is Monday night, June 29th at 7 o'clock, Honduran Social Movements Mobilizing for Justice, with Karen Spring doing a presentation, an event sponsored by the Community Alliance for Global Justice. And that will be 7 o'clock on Monday night at New Hope Missionary Baptist Church in the Central District, at 124 21st Avenue in the CD. So go and check that out as well. And as we mentioned earlier, it is going to be a very hot weekend. So when you're out partying or celebrating Pride or whatever it is that you want to celebrate this weekend, by all means, keep hydrating.
Yep.
And enjoy the sunshine.
Take some water with you.
Yep.